wrapping up and wages stay the same. I went down to the store for a can of beans. Lord, such prices I ain't never seen. I just reached over on the shelf. Has changed, as you well might know, and the price you see now, it won't last. If you want that can better, grab it fast. I'd trade my car just to get the rebate, so all my bill collectors wouldn't have to wait. But with my luck, there just ain't no doubt. When I walk in, the deal would run out. Man, if I lived to be 110, and this thing called inflation rolls round again, I'll dig me a hole about 10 feet deep, then cover me up and go to sleep. Oh, dig me up when this mess is over.
This is Dr. Howland Owl, and I would like to invite you to listen to the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on Radio Valencia. It's on Fridays, Friday night from 10 to midnight, and beyond. Who knows how late we run? I, Dr. Howland Owl, don't always know. But I promise you, this is the most amazing collection of radio memorabilia that you have ever had occasion to hear. The wonder, the terror, the savagery, and the splendor of Ask Dr. Hal live on radio. Call in and ask me a question, or any of the recondite crew who occasionally sits in. You yourself can join the party. It just takes a radio, the Ask Dr. Hal Show live on radio, and you, Friday nights, 10 to midnight on Radio Valencia.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl, and never ever think of counting sheep. When your lonely heart has learned its lesson, you'd be hers if only she would call. In the wee small hours of the that's the time you miss her most of lesson, you'd be hurt. years if only she would call. In the wee small hours of the morning, that's the time you miss her most. Of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl and never ever think of Cal.
It's the House of Pride Show with your host, Rika Turner.
Hey, it's Rick Turner here. How you doing? We've got a live show for you today with a couple guests. My first guest already in the studio with me, the one and only, the fabulous Lawrence Hellman. Hello, hello.
Well, hello there.
We're going to be right back with an in-depth interview with Sir Hellman right after this. You're listening to the House of Pride Show. Please like us on Facebook. House of Pride Radio. We love you guys. Riding on the freeway of love here in San Francisco with my buddy here, Lawrence Hellman. How are you doing?
I couldn't be lovelier. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're looking so glamorous today, Lawrence. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I always feel glamorous. I don't always look glamorous, but I feel glamorous.
You should feel glamorous because your life is so enriched with San Francisco culture, I would say, over the years. You've been in business for how many years, would you say?
Well, I've been in San Francisco. This year will be 40 years. That's 40, boys and girls, more than some of you have been alive. And
exactly. That makes sense to me, but...
Yeah, 40 years. It's like it went very, very, very quickly.
You're not from here originally.
Originally, no. I'm from New York City. I was born in Queens. Not to Queens, in Queens. And
What high school did you graduate from?
Francis Lewis, Franny Lou.
Franny Lou High School.
Franny Lou. Whose colors were green and orange. Kind of like every time I see green and orange together, I feel like I'm being expelled.
Yeah. So you're like grew up a city boy. You weren't naive or anything. You're right out in the mix.
Well, the thing I always tell people, when you grow up in New York City, I mean, even though we're in, it's funny because when you live in Queens, you know, New York City has five boroughs, and Queens is one of the boroughs. But when you went to Manhattan, you would always say, I'm going into the city, even though Queens was
larger, yeah.
So, you know, and I was lucky because my sister and I would be taken into Manhattan on weekends to go to museums and go to see Broadway shows and go to parks. And so, you know, and I always tell people this, and people aren't going to believe it, but when we went by train into Manhattan, you got dressed up. Like, you didn't wear jeans, you didn't wear shorts, you didn't wear, you know, something ratty, because you were going into the city, and you wanted to look good. You didn't want to look like a hick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was, like, in the early 60s, and, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That seems like I wish I could step back in time. And
it seems somewhat, you know, ridiculous. And we used to ride the F train, the old Black Beauties, which they were these black trains with rattan seats and open fans. You know, they were like noisy as all hell. And, you know, we would do that. So I grew up going into Manhattan and then winding up working in Manhattan. So you grow up kind of quick. You know, and you always have street smarts. Like, mm-hmm. You're always looking left and right because you know something could go wrong. You know, so you learn to be very aware of your surroundings.
Yes, and we're going to talk about your influences before you moved here from New York City right after this short musical break I'm dedicating to you. Of course, this is the 70s now. We're being treated with the extended mix.
Thank Christ.
Cut to the chase, all right?
Music plays, everyone's dancing. Closer and closer. Making friends and finding lovers. There you are, lost in the shadows. Searching for something, someone to set you free from New York City.
I don't know. Where did those yesterdays go?
You know, it's funny because some people have this, like, you know, idyllic kind of vision of New York. And I remember one of the movies that really repulsed me was that Woody Allen film Manhattan. You know, because I remember, you know, it was just like this vision of New York that was, you know, everything was gorgeous, and people lived in penthouses, and people would walk the streets, and you'd hear, like, you know, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And it's like, when I walked the streets in New York, I heard, like, you know, people cursing, people shooting up. I didn't hear Gershwin. And that movie just made me so violently ill, you know?
I thought you were going to say Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, well, you know, Saturday Night Fever was of its time.
Yes, the dawn of disco. Yeah. Well, not really, but mainstream, commercial mainstream disco.
Well, I remember the first time I ever saw John Travolta on stage was, I think it could have been in Grease, the musical, around 72 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then he was in a musical that's written by the Sherman Brothers, who did all the music for Disney, and it was starring the two remaining Andrews sisters. It was called Over Here.
Oh, my God.
And Patty and Laverne and Maxine. No, Patty and Maxine.
Yeah.
And he was in that, he was a, you know, a male ingenue.
And this is in the 70s?
74.
Before you moved to San Francisco.
I moved here in 86.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But no, so yeah, John Travolta in that before he did Saturday Night Fever, you know, and that was fun.
Yeah. And so you got a lot of experience already in your system before you came here in the 80s.
Well, yeah, you know, I was like, I always tell people, you know, we didn't have community theater in New York City. We had Broadway. You know, that was all there was, you know, so.
Broadway or bust.
Yeah, if you want to see a show, or off Broadway.
Yeah,
you know,
off.
You know, you didn't see like Guys and Dolls and at the Staten Island, you know, Rotary Club. You know, why do that when you, for a few dollars more, you could see Patti LuPone screaming her head off. So, I got the Broadway bug pretty early.
What was your major, or what was your focus in high school?
In high school?
Yeah.
Not getting evicted.
Okay.
Not getting expelled. I didn't, you know, no.
Yeah, that wasn't your... That wasn't the time that you excelled, but...
No. I hated those people, and I found out that you could, in your senior year, if you took two English classes, you can get out 6 months early, which is what I did. So I graduated in January and worked in Manhattan for 6 months before I went to college.
And what, did you go to New York to college?
No, I went to upstate New York, SUNY, State University of New York.
Which one?
A town called Binghamton.
Binghamton, wow.
Which I like to call the other Hampton.
Yeah.
No P. And that, it was
that's
you
way,
know, upstate
way
New York,
out there on the west side.
On the southern tier, an hour north of Scranton.
God bless you.
But it was cold. It was winter.
Yeah.
And it was. I always say New York has two seasons, New York State. It's winter and August.
What did you major in out there?
In film, in cinema.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to do any work.
So who were your inspirations in college? Who inspired you? Who were you like...
I studied film. It was an interesting program because it was a non-narrative film program, so it was experimental. It was very, very similar to the Art Institute here. May it rest in peace. You know, that was also teaching non-narrative film with the Kuchar brothers and Ernie Gare and people like that and Stan Brakhage. So it was that kind of thing. So it was not, it was studying an aspect of film that I wouldn't normally have delved into. So that was kind of fun, you know. And you were a bunch of arty crowd, and went to school with Alan Berliner, who's now a pretty famous documentary filmmaker. Also in my class was this guy named Ed Batchelor, and he was Joseph Cornell's nephew. So there were very interesting kind of people floating around, and a lot of people went to Binghamton. Margaret Gomez went to Binghamton. Mark Huestis went to Binghamton. Carol Leifer went to Binghamton. Paul Reiser went to Binghamton. So
the school to go to for film.
No, they were all just studying English and doing drugs like everybody else. But a lot of people went to what's her name? Camille Paglio went to Binghamton. It was a good school. It was cheap. I remember at the time even thinking
SUNY. The
state
system,
schools.
It was very affordable.
They were like $3,000 a year.
Yeah, back then.
And even then, it was very reasonable.
I went to SUNY Purchase.
Purchase.
Yeah, which is closer
to
New York.
What did you study?
I have a BA in painting and drawing.
Oh,
Judy Bernstein. Hello.
Congratulations. How's that working out for you?
You know what? I sell a few paintings a year, oil paintings of the golf course.
And you're still paying off your student loan?
I paid it off.
Good.
Yeah. But not from there. I originally went to Vermont. That was a mistake. Linden State College for a year and a half. That's where all the loans were. But a Purchase was easy. Like you said, it's affordable. Should have went to Purchase originally. But, as in life is very fluid, so a little detour, and then back to finally got in the Purchase. Anywho.
Well, if I must say, you haven't lost your New York accent,
which surprises me, because I didn't grow up in the city.
Uh-huh.
Grew up on East Long Island.
You still got it.
Yeah. Anywho, enough about me.
Anywho.
So I would say you were seasoned to move here. What was the inspiration to hightail it over to San Francisco?
Well, people always say, what brought you out to California?
Yeah.
And I say I rented a car. But
you must have known.
No, I went to college, and then I moved back to New York, and then I got a job in film, and I worked in film for about 8 years.
Yeah.
8 years. And then I'll tell you about that in a second. But then I just, I had friends who moved out here. So I would, in the summer I would come visit. And many times.
Yeah.
Because I like that it started coming in 72, but then, you know.
Were you out at this point?
No. But in the late 70s, I would come out early. And then in 84, I said, well, let me try it. So I moved out here, rented a place for the summer, got a job, and then went back just to see if I could live here for 2 months, get a job, and not be on vacation and see if I liked it. Mm-hmm. And I did. So then I 2 years later, I moved out here. But, So
you were working in film in New York City.
Yeah, when I graduated from this film school.
In Binghamton.
the other Hampton.
Yes.
Which didn't give me any experience.
The west of the Hamptons.
Yeah. So I got a job in film for a small production company. They were commercials, industrials, and they had the account for Viacom, which was... Had TV shows and syndication series like Gunsmoke, The Honeymooners, Lucy's, Petticoat Junction, you know, things that ran forever. And then they would line up foreign dubbing to the syndicated picture track, which had been cut down. So we would line up, you know, Spanish, French, German, sometimes Portuguese. So I did that for a long time. And then I wanted to work in feature films. So my lunch hour, there were two actually places that had rented cutting rooms for features, and one was the Brill Building, 1619 Broadway, the famous Brill Building where all the songwriters went in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know anybody. I knocked on doors, and finally someone gave me a chance, and it was on this, you know, first film for these two guys, producer, director, who had a small company, named after their parents. The parents were Mira and Max. So it was a company called Miramax, and it was two guys named Harvey and Bob Weinstein, and they were doing their first movie. So I got a job on that, and they were in the cutting room like every day. And, you know, then I kind of, the movie came out, it was a stupid little movie, and then I moved out here, and then Miramax in the 80s became Miramax, and I'm like, those guys? Those two schlubby guys from Queens? Although Harvey Weinstein was never laid a hand on me, just saying. And then I worked on a couple of other films.
Here?
In New York.
Oh, yeah.
And then the last movie I worked on in New York before I moved to California was a big Universal film called Brighton Beach Memoirs, which came out in 85 or 86. And that was a good movie to work on. It was a big, big Hollywood, you know, movie.
Yeah, I remember that movie.
Yeah, and Neil Simon wrote it, and it was directed by Gene Sachs. And Gene Sachs was a famous director. He did a lot of Neil Simon's plays and movies, and he was married to Bea Arthur for 25 years. They had two kids together, and I love Gene. We got together. We worked together very well. He liked me. He was like an old vaudeville guy. And then I moved out here.
Yes, and here you are still.
Yeah, so I don't know. I moved out here, and I didn't want to work in film anymore.
Why not?
Because I was over it.
You know?
It was just like, it was long hours, and, you know, it was just, I looked at people who were in the jobs I wanted to be, and I could get there maybe in like 4 or 5 years, and they were all miserable. So I said to myself, cut your losses and just, you don't want to be miserable in 5 years, you know? I could be miserable now. So, so I just decided to come out. So I moved out here, I worked in food, and then I got into cater waiting, and then one day I was walking on the Yellow Brick Road, and I saw Mark Huestis, and he was putting up, Mark Huestis, the documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, shout out to Mark. He's in Palm Springs now, I believe.
He is in Palm Springs, or as he called us, Embalmed Springs.
That's funny. That should be the name of a Mark,
if you're listening. And so he was putting up posters with his staple gun on a telephone pole, and I said, what are you doing? And I had heard about Mark because I'd seen his films in New York. A friend of mine from San Francisco said you should see this film that he worked on called Whatever Happened to Susan Jane, and it was terrific, and I loved it. And so I knew who he was, and I said, what are you working on? He goes, oh, I'm doing a fundraiser for a documentary called Sexes, that, you know, it's at the Roxy, why don't you come and help? I said, yeah, if you need any help. He said, sure. So I don't know, I think I ran a spotlight that night or something.
Fun. I love that.
Yeah, it was. I don't know. And then 3 weeks later, I was producing the film with him, and he asked me to do that. And I said, I don't know. What does that mean? He goes, oh, you'll figure it out. And that took 5 years.
The film, yeah.
Mostly raising money because of course, yeah. It was expensive. And but, you know...
And what film was this?
Sex Is, a documentary that came out in 1993, exploring the meaning of sex and sexuality in the lives of gay men.
Okay, and were you out at this point?
Oh, I was so out, you couldn't put me back in, honey.
When did that happen, as soon as you got here?
It was on... No, it was before that, but it was...
It happened.
It just didn't.
It was the right time.
Yeah, it never even seemed to be a big deal. It was just, oh yeah, whatever, you know. And
was it in San Francisco or New York? Your first time.
Oh, it was definitely in New York.
Oh, okay. You came out in New York.
Well, I didn't come out. I was. Well, you had fun.
You had fun in New York.
So, So we worked on that for 5 years, mm-hmm. and we opened at the Berlin Film Festival, which is a very big film festival in this.
Awesome! Congratulations!
And everyone loved it, and no one wanted to distribute it, so we distributed it ourselves on 16mm. At the time, most. Cities had an art house that could show 16mm.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
So like the Roxy is now, but there was like, you know, the Thalia in New York, the Biograph in D.C., and every major, Chicago, the Music Box. Yeah, you know, it was a small theater that could, you know, that could show, independent, that could show this stuff.
What did you name your distribution company?
Well, it was Outsider Productions.
Outsider Productions, I love it.
Because that was Mark. Because the source material for Whatever Happened to Susan Jane was this 50s, like, you know...
Biker?
No, it was a school, a film, educational film about the girl who doesn't fit in, and it was called The Outsider.
Gotcha.
And Mark took chunks of that and updated it to San Francisco now. It was a lot was shot at the Cafe Foot. It's a great movie.
I love that kind of humor, yes.
Yeah, it's, I think it's available on YouTube, at a YouTube near you.
Yeah, so you distributed Sex Is.
We distributed ourselves, and the film grossed over $1 million. We didn't see
that's hugely successful.
It was very successful.
Didn't see it because the house kept...
They take 60%, and then you have to pay for all the advertising, and you know, so you don't make any money. It's very glamorous.
How much did it cost to produce that film?
I don't know, but I know.
Did you get enough money for car gas, or you know, a little bit?
Maybe
residual.
Maybe we could have like.
It's like anything else.
Yeah. It's very glamorous on paper. In reality, I mean, you know, they fly you out to film festivals, and that's kind of fun. You get to travel a lot, but then you come home and you have to pay your rent, and you don't.
The money's not there. It reminds me of like you know I have House of Pride Music. Indie music label. I don't know if you knew that, but you know, we release songs that go to number one on major record pools. And in that business, it's the same thing. You know, maybe money trickles in, you know, every month, but it's not enough to sustain a livelihood. But we don't really do it for that, right?
How much more time do we have?
As long as you want, honey.
Oh, I love it. Thank you. I started doing publicity because we did the PR for the film ourselves, and then other people said, "Who's doing your PR?" And they said, "We are." And they said, "Oh, I have this little project. Would you help?" So I started doing that, and then in 13 years later, or 12 years later, I wanted to make a documentary about Peter Berlin, the famous 70s porn star, because he lives in San Francisco. And I would see him around a lot, and they never talked to him, but I would always see him, and he was fascinating to me.
Yeah,
and I got friendly with Peter, and it turned out I wasn't the person to make the film, and then I found that someone else was making the film, and then I contacted him, this guy named Jim Tyshinsky, and we had these great talks, and I started saying, well, why don't you do this, and why don't you do that, and then 2 weeks later, I was producing the film.
That's great.
With him.
As you should.
And that was, Jim was great, because he was the cameraman, he was the director, he was the interviewer, very, very bare bones, and he was a very good editor, and he also trusted my opinion on editing. So he would show me rough cuts, and we would have, you know, these intense sessions about
and productive partners.
Yeah, and he was very good, and the film came out wonderful, and that also premiered in Berlin at the Berlin Film Festival, that, you know, went pretty much. We did a couple of theatrical releases, but not much because by that point distribution had changed.
Yeah,
but
looking at your resume now and the. You've worked with so many stars. Can we just skip to your involvement with Peaches Christ Productions?
Well, yeah. You know, I've known Peaches forever. You know,
Peaches.
We always were in the same orbit. Hey, Josh. And, you know, his stuff was always, you know, he had been sniffing around me, you know, and never wanted to hire me because I was either too expensive or it was too late. And finally, he asked me, he was doing these live shows at the Castro Theater, mm-hmm. you know. So I did about 3 or 4 of them for him. And, you know, I didn't even know if I did anything because his stuff is so widely successful. Everyone wants to go. And it was the old Castro Theater when it was a movie theater.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he was great to work with. And the shows were a riot. And, you know, big productions that were with cardboard scenery. And
I love it. As I mentioned to you, I love his sensibility for humor. It's just top-notch.
Yeah, and he, you know, just had a great way of bringing people together. He's a great producer.
Great entertainer, too.
Yeah, he's fun. And he's busy. You know, he's a busy girl. So I work with, I've been doing my own PR business now for almost 30 years. I work with a lot of theater, I work with a lot of gay theater. I did Theater Rhinoceros, which is the oldest gay lesbian theater.
Yeah, is that still around? I know it moved.
It is still around. It's now run by John Fisher. John's been running it for maybe 20, 25 years. Yeah. And now they have a permanent home in this tiny little storefront on 18th Street next to...
the Castro.
Next to Molly Stone's.
Yeah, that's right. Very
and,
cool.
And John is making it work. And they the next show they're doing La Cage aux Folles in a theater that holds 30 people.
Are you promoting?
No. So God bless them. They're the oldest, you know, gay and lesbian theater company in existence.
Yeah. Again, they take something and twist it into something really humorous.
They
used to.
Yeah. Now John, you know, he's so prolific as a playwright, and I think he writes like a play a week.
Okay, so different. It's a different experience.
So it's a lot of John Fisher stuff, and John is in them a lot. He directs them a lot.
I see it in my feeds and stuff.
Yeah. You should check out Theater Rhinoceros.
I should. You send me over a great company called Circus Bella.
Oh, Circus Bella.
A couple months ago. That was so much fun.
Circus Bella. Let me tell you about Circus Bella.
Tell me.
I've been working with Circus Bella now for four years. So what they do, first of all, they're run by the marvelously talented Abigail Munn.
Yes. Shout out to Abigail. She came in actually here.
Oh.
Yeah, physically sat
Abigail
where you
Munn,
are.
Abigail Munn. The woman should be sainted. So She's a performer, she's a business person, and she runs a circus. So Circus Bella is a small one-ring circus. In the summer, they do free performances in Bay Area parks. They also go to Laguna Beach. And then in the winter, for the past 3 years, they've been putting up a big circus tent down by the Embarcadero at the crossing at East Cut.
Yeah, did you go to the last show I did? It was great.
I work with them.
Oh, yeah, of course you were there. You were probably there the night I went with Bernadette Bowen. Shout out to Bernadette. We had great seats. They gave us great seats.
They charge money for that one. And it's a wonderful circus. And it's very kid-friendly. And it's world-class acts. And Abigail, she has a great background for San Francisco, you know, born and raised. And her father was Thomas Munn, who passed away a couple of years ago. And he was the head lighting designer for the San Francisco Opera for over 30 years. So Abigail always says, you know, I grew up in the opera house because that's where my dad worked. I think he was like the lighting director for 7 opera directors. And he was just there forever. And her mother, Susan, worked for the Maryland program and, you know, great, great people. So Abigail comes, and Abigail was a trapeze artist, ran off and did the circus. And also, the thing about Circus Bella, they work with a live band, 6-piece band, which is phenomenal for a circus company, and their costumes are amazing. Abigail's childhood friend is Autumn Adam, who runs Dark Garden Corsetry.
Ooh.
So they make all their costumes, and they're incredible. It's a wonderful
company. Everyone looked fitted.
Yeah. Oh, so what? They spent a lot of money on costumes and on the band. And 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, the guy who wrote most of the music and who worked with Abigail as the band leader for 16 years passed away very suddenly, named Rob Reich. And Rob was an inspiration. His music was magnificent, and a lot of his music is still being played with the band, and that was a big loss. Rob was very, very beloved in the San Francisco musical community, and is missed every day. So, you know, even in the circus, there's a little bit of sadness. But you know, I work with Theater Rhinoceros. I work with San Francisco Mime Troupe. I work with them for over like 12 years.
Yeah. What you got coming up this year?
Well, yeah, I work with the Mime Troupe. I work with Circus Bella.
Like a new colorful page for you.
I also work with the Golden Gate Park Band.
Oh, what's that? That's interesting.
The Golden Gate Park Band has been around since 1882.
Wow, that's a slice of San Francisco history, folks.
It's the only thing older, I think, is the cable car or the cable cars. And yeah. they
And earthquakes.
This is their earthquakes. This is their 144th season coming up. And in the press release I write, none of the original band members are currently with the group, because that's a joke.
Well, they might be there in spirit.
They are in spirit. And they have these red hats and red sport coats. And every Sunday for 5 months, from the end of April to the end of September,
coming up.
Sundays at 1 o'clock, is a 90-minute concert by 30 musicians who are all paid and union members. Yeah. And it's free in the band shell at Golden Gate Park. And the band shell, when it was dedicated by the Spreckles family in 1900, one of the bylaws of that band shell is that nothing can be presented there with an admission charge. Okay. Everything has to be free.
Oh, nice.
Which is absolutely wonderful.
So the city is covering the cost of everything?
Well, yeah. I mean,
yeah, like a grant or...
People get grants. Yeah. And, yeah. So they get money from the hotel tax fund or, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's free. And people can donate, you know, can give.
You know, I love this. I love this slice of history, you know.
144 years.
Yeah. Where... Now, refresh my memory, folks who don't know. Where is the shell located?
It's in Golden Gate Park. It's right in between the DeYoung Museum and the Academy of Sciences.
Okay.
Which was, that whole area was first christened in the exposition of, I think it was 1895 or 1896. Mm-hmm. And that was the first exhibition of outdoor lighting on the West Coast.
Oh, very cool. And what would folks expect to experience? What genre of music do they play?
Well, it's band music.
Like big band? Or?
No. It's all, you know, John Philip Sousa.
Okay.
You know, it's all, there's no strings. It's, you know.
Horns.
It's horns, it's tubas.
And percussion.
It's drums.
Yeah.
And, about 10 of 10 or 12 programs of their 5 month season, they take and present a cultural group. So they'll have like Hungarian, they'll have Irish, they'll have Mexican, they'll have a pride celebration. They do,
oh, fun.
You know, so they have 12 of those a year. And it's magnificent. And people come out and they have like, you know, a Polish one, and they have folk dancing and with the band. And it's free, and people just go out into the park.
So each time would be a different experience.
It's goldengateparkband.org, and that'll be the schedule, which just went up. And you know, I've worked with
did you do the gay men's choir ever?
Gay men's chorus, no, but I volunteer for them over at the Chan Center because I like what they do.
Absolutely.
But, I work in 46. Oh, I've worked with the Golden Girls, with Heckler.
You have so many. He's, you know, looking at his list. He's like, can't remember so many.
I can't remember anything. But I got together with Heckelina many.
God bless her soul. Yes.
She's looking down at us and laughing. And that great laugh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's how I got my start, 96, 97, with the Training Shack when it was just getting off the ground. I was a member in the Sick and Twisted Theater. Were you involved with them?
No, but I was a very big supporter of that.
Tony Bagley. He's still here.
Hi, Tony.
Hey, Tony. We love him. He's been on the show.
The stuff that Tony did with the Sick and Twisted was...
Off the wall.
It was off the wall, and it was like, you know, they would take, like, these two things, like Beverly Hills... You know, 90210 and Carrie, and do a mashup.
Yeah, Brady Bunch and something.
Yeah, they were like, one thing was funnier than the next, and that's what gave Heckelina her start, was in that.
Yeah, and people would come to see how they patched, like, expectations together, like with props and, you know, how to get from A to B. Like people would.
There was no technical.
Exactly. It was improv.
When they did carry and they had to do the telekinesis, someone just moved the chair with a black glove from behind. It was hysterical.
Or there was a wire for the knives, but sometimes the knife would get stuck in the middle of the you know, moving it from one place.
Or I remember my favorite one, Tony was like fixated on the Poseidon Adventure.
So. Oh my God, yes. Who's not, though?
Right, that's true. So the Poseidon Adventure, the name of the show was the Poseidon Adventure .. You will get wet. So it's like, what?
Bring a plastic.
No. So when you checked in, they would give you a big plastic hefty bag.
Oh, perfect.
And then you would say, what's this for? And they'd say, oh, you'll figure it out.
That's before that comedian that used to do the watermelons. That's probably where he got the idea.
So, yeah. And then I worked at, you know, the Miss Tranny Shack pageant for years. And then Eklina was doing Golden Girls twice a year.
And that blew up.
So then he wanted to move it, do the Christmas episodes from John Sims Center to the Victoria. And that was going from like a 100-seater to a 500-seater. And he was nervous that they weren't going to sell out. So he hired me, and I did their PR for 7 years. And
Well, you were very successful.
Well, it was people just loved the gold. I'm telling you.
But I think you got the word out to a wider audience, would you say?
We did. But that one sold itself.
Yeah, it was a good brand.
I would say maybe 40% was gay. The rest were just like, you know, everybody else who just loved this. People would have office parties there. They would bring their mother and their grandmother, and it was a thing.
And now the legacy continues. I mean, Cookie Dough was a cast member at one point. God bless her soul.
God bless Cookie Dough.
And that, and so even now, and Poyle was in there at one
Poyle
point.
Poyle Delmar.
But the current cast, are you still promoting Golden Girls?
No.
Yeah, because it has like a life of its own at this point.
Yeah, they got too big.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's Darcy. Bless St. Darcy.
She is quite a talent in our culture, isn't she?
I started working with Darcy in 97, doing the show, his small shows. And
I told her, I said, for years, I swore you were like a real girl, like a fish. You know.
Remember Enrique?
I had no idea it was a guy.
No, remember that group Enrique that Darcy did with Jason Mercier? And that was terrific. Anyway, so now Golden Girls is Darcy, and it's the fabulously talented Matthew Martin.
Yes, love him.
It's a whole lot of time.
Yes, a whole lot
Sophia
of time.
Petrillo.
She's amazing.
And who's the fourth one?
She doesn't live here. It's a big name, isn't it?
Oh, it's Coco Peru.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That's right.
Okay.
So that's she's relative. I'd say a few years in.
This will be like her fourth year.
Yeah.
Coming up.
So top-notch talent.
I worked with Coco before. What? She was doing a show with Mark Eustace, and I was helping Mark, and he said, "Just be Coco's handler."
Yeah.
So I go. Okay, fine.
Two handler.
So I go backstage, and I go, "Hi, Coco, it's Lawrence. We had met before." She goes, "Hi," and she's in the dressing room. I said, "Mark asked me to be your handler." So she looks at me. She goes, "So handle me." I mean, come on.
Give me an example.
But anyway, so Coco is now doing the B. Arthur role that Helena did.
Yeah.
And those are big shoes, literally, to fit.
I mean, I think those shoes fit.
Well, and she's, you know, eased on right into that whole.
Yeah.
Now they're doing it at the Curran Theater.
Yeah, it's
which
as
is,
it should be. I mean, it's evolved into this yearly wonderful experience for many, many people.
Yeah, and the thing that is great about the Curran Theater is because Matthew Martin is such a Bette Davis, you know, not only imitator but fan.
I just saw him on Tubi. They're running Hush Hush.
Oh, yeah, Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte.
That's a Billy Clift production.
Billy Clift, who's...
Which you probably are friends with.
No, I've known Billy. But,
yeah, for many years.
But the thing about... the Curran Theater is that's where they shot a lot of the interior shots for All About Eve with Bette Davis.
Oh, nice.
So to Matthew Martin, that is like this sacrosanct ground, and you know, he can't believe that he's working in that theater.
He's got that Bette Davis impersonation down
kinda.
Yeah. Shout out to you. Come on back. It's been a while since he's been on House of Pride Radio. Well, it's been a switch from Muni Radio Station to here, but this first time you've been a guest.
It is.
You've been like serving me talent for many years, and I'm glad that.
Well, I always tell people, you know, I don't really have the yen to be in the spotlight. I always say if I did my autobiography would be called Scrapbooks Full of Me in the Background, to quote Stephen Sondheim from Gypsy in Rose's Turn. But, you know, it's just like I work with so many people, and I love promoting the amazing talent that we have in the Bay Area. And
that's one of the great things about San Francisco, is it still attracts that quirky,
it's amazing,
yeah, gay culture and talent.
Although it's harder to get to be an artist now because it's so expensive.
It's how do people, young people, do it?
They have sex for money. I don't know.
Sex for money. Or a good tech job, and then, like, you know, theater on the side.
That's true. But
one of my favorite people you've worked with, the Kung Pao culture.
Oh, yeah. Well, Lisa Gadul, shout out to Lisa. Hi, Lisa.
Yeah. Hi, Lisa.
We used to live across the hall from each other on 17th Street in the Mission. And she started doing this Kung Pao kosher comedy with Jewish comedians in a Chinese restaurant at Christmas. And we did that.
That's
I
so
worked
funny.
With her for 30 years on that.
That's an in-joke.
And it's still going on.
Yeah.
And then one of the people I work with who I miss terribly is Leslie Jordan. And Leslie Jordan was part of the Richmond Ehrman Aid Foundation, one of the celebrities. He would be a frequent guest and just do his comedy. And hysterical, the nicest guy. And then he said he was coming to San Francisco to do a one-person show for the summer one year, with a great title called Like a Dog on Linoleum. And I said, it's hysterical. Who's doing your publicity? He goes, I don't know. And I said, well, I'd love to do it. He goes, well, I'll ask my producer.
Son.
And then I did his I think I did two of them. And I miss him terribly. He was so funny. He called me one day. We're in the car. I'm taking him to a radio thing. And he said, I'm going to call you Lurline. And I'm like, pardon? And he said, well, you know, it's a typical Southern name, and I always had a Lurline in my life, so I'm just going to call you Lurline. Aww. And I'm like, all right. But, yeah, so I miss him.
I like your Southern accent.
I miss him terribly. You know, and Thrill Peddlers. Can we mention Thrill Peddlers?
Let's do it.
I don't know if people remember, but for a while, it was a magical time in San Francisco. There was a theater director and producer named Russell Blackwood. Hi, Russell. And Russell had this idea to do Cockettes musicals. And he hooked up with Scrumbly Coldwin. Hi, Scrumbly. Mm-hmm. Who was just turned 80. I was at his birthday party. And Scrumbly was one of the original Cockettes.
Yeah, and for folks who don't know, the Cockettes go a little further back.
Oy.
To
the Cockettes,
North Beach, I want to say, or
yeah, it was like 1970. They were like 70 to 72, very short lived, and they were a bunch of ragtag LSD hippies who, you know, were doing musicals and lived in communes, and they put on shows at the Palace Theater in North Beach, which was we used to show like Asian, you know, it was like an Asian art house, show Asian, you know, kung fu movies and Chinese opera and stuff like that. And so Russell kind of got together with Scrumbly, and they remounted these Cockettes musicals.
Did they put a twist on it?
They were twisted.
They were already twisted.
You know, and then the Pearls Over Shanghai and Vice Palace and, you know, Tinsel Tarts in a Hot Coma and Hot Greek. So I worked with them for like almost 10 years. And in this tiny little theater by Trader Joe's on Division Street.
Oh, my God. How many seats?
45 seats.
Oh, nice.
And
That is intimate.
And Pearls Over Shanghai had a cast of 26.
Oh.
So it looked like sometimes there were more people on stage than in the audience.
That's so funny.
It was hysterical. And you asked Russell, do you have to have 26 people? He said, absolutely. We couldn't do it with less.
Yeah.
And those shows were just incredible. It was like gay vaudeville, kind of the stuff that the ridiculous theater like Charles Ludlam used to do.
Is it still going on? I heard of it.
No. They lost the theater. They sold the building.
Oh.
And they had a sweet deal there where they weren't paying rent, and they had this theater all to themselves, and no one else used it.
Oh, okay. I was going to say 26 people is a lot to divvy up the proceeds.
Oh, yeah. Well, no one made any money.
No.
And I always felt when I had to describe the kind of theater it was, I would say, well, the Thrill Peddlers are like a family, but it's a cross between the Partridge Family and the Manson Family.
Nice.
Because that was like, and it was the best theater, the best theater. I mean, people were just like, could not believe how good it was, the makeup, the hair, the makeup. you know. Mm-hmm. And when they sold the building, the people that bought it said it took them like months to get all the glitter out of the building. It
was just That's like, probably glitter still there somewhere. Yeah. You can never really get rid of 100%.
Yeah.
Great. You know, slices of our culture come and go. Well, let's talk about a little bit about you, your personal life, if you don't mind. I'm just curious.
What's your next question?
Yeah, are you in a relationship?
No, I'm just old. I turned 70 last year.
You don't come across as 70, which is a fine age. I'm just saying
I look better on radio. Let's just say. I have a face for radio. And,
Were you successful here in gay culture, building a family and a relationship, or are you more like a solo guy?
I've had
I'm curious.
A couple of major relationships. I moved out here with a partner who had two kids.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
From New York?
Yeah.
In 86?
Yeah, the kids would come out on summers, and then...
That's big time.
They lived with us for a couple of years, and they went to Everett Middle School, so I was like the evil stepmother. Mm-hmm. And then that ended, and he went back to New York and passed away, and then I had another relationship for about almost 9 years, and then that ended, and so, you know, I'm...
Those are significant slices of your life, for sure. So right now you're single, folks. He's available.
Yeah, very single. Single and invisible, because when you turn, you know...
I've been noticing that, too, but, I mean, is that a state of mind? Is it really real, or is it... you know what I've learned is that, like Mariah Carey says, you just have to make it happen. You know what? If you want something, you have to, like, make it happen.
Worst case, so you just have to make it with somebody.
Make it. Like, it's true, though. Like, if I want to do something, nobody's going to do it for me. I've got to just do it. And then it usually has some level of success. Yeah.
Well, lately I've been volunteering a lot at theater companies that I like to work, like to go see, and that's been really nice because
you can get anywhere volunteering.
Yeah, and number one, it gets me out of the house. I get to wear clean underwear, which is nice, and then I'm around my people.
Yeah.
You know, and they're happy to have you. I'm happy to be there and help. And, you know, it's a win-win. And you know, people who are like stuck in ruts, I always say, volunteer for organizations that you like.
Yeah, I need to do one or two.
I started working with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. I started working with the City Arts and Lectures, with the Presidio Theater, and it's wonderful. And you get to see...
What do you do? Just knock on the door and say, hey, do you have any volunteer?
Just find out who's a volunteer coordinator. And, you know, I also work at New Conservatory Theater. Mm-hmm. There's a guy named Martin who runs the volunteer program. He's wonderful. And they're just doing a great show now, which is... Gods and Monsters, starring Donald Curry, at the New Conservatory Theater.
Great title.
Well, it's based on there's a book called Gods and Monsters,
and then there was
they
a movie.
Made the movie.
That's
with,
about Frankenstein.
Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser.
That was a good movie.
It was a great movie.
Yeah.
And it's about the life of James Whale, who was this gay director in the 30s in Hollywood from Britain. And he directed Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein. And Showboat.
Who was the actress? Was that Faye Ray in Bride of... No, it was not. It was
Elsa Lancaster.
Lancaster, that's right.
She was great. That's a good show to see.
Yeah.
I'm also a Sondheim queen.
A what?
A Sondheim queen.
Okay, do explain.
For those of you who don't know what a queen is. No, a Sondheim queen is... It's Stephen Sondheim, who's the recently departed musical... comedy, musical director, writer, producer, composer, everything. And I got turned on to Mr. Sondheim very early on, 1970, when I went to see Company. And then the next year I went to see Follies. This is all in New York on Broadway. And I saw Follies at a matinee, and then I couldn't move after it was over. And then I went to the box office and bought a ticket for the evening performance because I couldn't believe what I had just seen. And I was 16, and I said, that's it. You know, this is it. And then he went on to write, you know, Sweeney Todd and Anyone Can Whistle and Into the Woods and A Little Night Music, which is also a masterpiece, and Assassins, which is currently playing at the Oakland Theater Project in Oakland, just opened up, getting great reviews, and it's an ensemble piece, and the Oakland Theater Project is doing it with one performer.
Hmm.
So, and it's just been getting rave reviews.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend people go see that.
Yes. And where can folks go to keep track of who you're promoting? And
Well, you know, it's funny because I don't have a website. I always use the website of the... But I'm on Facebook, Lawrence Hellman.
Yeah.
And I promote everything there. And I use that Instagram thing every now and then. But I don't know how it works. And
But if you're like... in the media, you should contact Lawrence if you're not already on his mailing list, I would say.
Yeah, and I'll put you on my press list, and you'll see what's going on. But I post everything on Facebook.
I love your press kits. They're very... One thing that stands out is how detailed the press kits are. I love it. It's very organized, I would
say. You have to give people the information.
Yeah.
Like, I just got a brochure, a six-page brochure for this opera company in the East Bay, and they're doing three operas in the summer. And they're great, and I go to see them. And they have the name of the theater on this big brochure, and nowhere on this brochure is the address of the theater.
Oh.
And I'm like, what the hell? You know, you have to make it very, very easy for people.
Right, because...
Everyone's confused, and everyone is so pulled in every direction.
It's hard to take in all that information. You know, that happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I always want to make, you know...
You're the right person for that.
And, you know, I'm always like, you know, let me see the promotional materials before they go out, because sometimes the dates are wrong, sometimes it's black type on a black background, you know, you can't read it, so that kind of stuff. And I'm always suggesting how to make it better, to make it easier for people.
That's right. And so that's Lawrence Hellman at, if anybody needs to contact him for future promotions. Just call you?
That's Hellman, H-E-L-M-A-N. Yeah, you know, just you can contact me, and I'm around, and, you know, I started working with this new theater company, well, not new to me, called, I should know this.
Yeah, what's the new one?
Central Works.
Central Works.
They're in Berkeley, and they've been around for 35, 36 years, and they do always original work. Usually they're one act, sometimes there's an intermission, but they do their shows at the Berkeley City Club, which is this amazing building on Durant, built by Julia Morgan, the architect, the famous architect, and it looks like a castle in Venice, and it's beautiful. And they're, you know, they're one of their plays that they did last year called Push Pull just won the Will Glickman Award for Best New Play of 25. They're a great little company. So I just started working with them, and they're doing a show which is just ending this weekend called After Happy, written by Patricia Milton. So there we are.
I'm glad you're still in the mix, volunteering, working. Folks, it's his email if you need to contact him. heytheresells@gmail.com. And call him if you need help and want to go on a date with him. 415-336-8220. You're listening to the House of Pride show. Lawrence, can we also have a top 10 dance countdown with LGBTQ friendly and gay artists? Will you do me the honors to start things off at the number 10 position?
Okay.
Yeah.
I love new material.
Yeah.
So what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to read the what's coming up?
Yeah, just read. We're going into the top 10 countdown. We're going to